Well, good afternoon, everyone. It is really an honor to be here. I take great pleasure whenever I have an opportunity to celebrate outstanding achievement. My view of the world is that there are enormous pressures on all of us to be quiet and to be passive and to be spectators and to anonymously applaud others. And therefore, this kind of ceremony means a lot to me because it's celebrating achievement and exertion and determination and commitment. I just value these traits so much, and all of you should be proud that you have them. What I'm going to do today is make a few remarks based on my life about what it means to be a scholar, my vision of a scholar. In fact, the title of my comments is Visions of a Scholar, or Visions of Scholars. These are visions of you, and I want to preface my comments by pointing out that I do see the world very differently from many people. And part of it is something that I didn't realize until this morning, that many people didn't know about me. I have a condition called myopia. And what that means basically is, you know, this is a vast room, but I see it as if it were a postcard. I don't have any sense of depth perception. And it affects my life in interesting ways. For example, in sports, in high school and even early college, I was very good at wrestling and at long distance running, but if there was anything with a ball, a basketball or baseball, I was terrible because those require your ability to track things across space. And I'd be picked for volleyball teams, and it was just a disaster because the ball would come by and I'd always miss it. But one of the things that I've developed as a coping mechanism is having a focal point. And my focal point when I see people is their eyes. I really love eyes in a profound way. When I meet strangers, I have to actually pull back because you enter a room and I'm staring at your eyes and you go, oh, what's happening? But I think eyes tell a truth that other things about a person's dress, a person's gestures, a person's voice don't reveal. I think eyes tell you about a person's history of pain and hurt. You see a lot of wisdom in eyes. You see a lot of passion. And I think one of my favorite traits, you see a lot of gentleness. And so one of the reasons I teach and I enjoy teaching so much is that when I see students come into my class, especially the first year at the university, there's a lot of hope and faith and excitement, and it's just really beautiful. It's very gratifying. I also call my talk Visions of Scholars, in the plural, because I'm going to tell you about my vision, but this is a public event. And lots of people are observing you and all the pomp and circumstance and the color and the sounds. And there are going to be a lot of other visions of you as scholars. Some of you, you're going to have friends and neighbors and children in some cases, and siblings. And what they're going to see here is they're going to be in a lot of awe. And by the pomp and the circumstance, and they're going to know intuitively that this is an important event, that you're doing something that's socially important and deserves recognition. And then there are others in the audience that I would separate out, and these are the ones who know you in a very deep and profound way. These are your parents and your grandparents and significant others. And I have watched my spouse graduate from the University of Connecticut, and I've watched both of my children graduate. One was from the University of Connecticut. And I don't know if the students can imagine what's going on in the parents and grandparents and spouses and other significant others' minds, but I think it's something like this. I think right now they see you as the most splendid and beautiful creature that ever walked the earth, and they think that it is really, really special what's happening today. So there are lots of visions, and now I'm going to tell you something about my vision. I think that you've been transformed during your years here. I think not only do you have an abundance of information and a lot of technical analytic skills, but I think you are now ready to go out in the world and treat yourself differently and present yourself differently. I sometimes call it presenting yourself as an author, as an authority, because you're going to be able to give your reasons for your positions. And you're also, people are going to be stunned because you're going to be able to shift perspectives and points of view. And they're going to take your thoughts and your ideas and comments seriously in a way that they didn't before. Now, to make my point a little more accessible, I'm going to tell some stories about myself. I think the specifics of my stories are quite different from your lives, but I think they're general truths that my stories will illustrate. And I just find that sometimes stories make it easier to apprehend certain types of truth than just exposition of abstract principles. As Dean Teitelbaum pointed out, I've been very fortunate. I went to a number of institutions. I'm very proud that I attended. But in fact, when I went to college, when I started college, I did not see myself as a scholar, and I wasn't sure why I was going to college. And I went largely out of a sense of duty to my parents, that it meant a lot to them, and they worked very hard for me. And I also did it partly because of the war in Vietnam. I had a very low draft number. Some of you may not know how the draft worked in those days, but I look back on it, I'm just stunned. It was as if they had a bingo, one of these bingo things they show on TV, and the numbers would pop out. And if you got a low number, that was terrible news. That meant that you had a very high chance of going to war. And I received a low number, and I didn't know how to handle the situation, partly because I felt very strongly that I needed to serve. And it was my country. I was first generation American, and it was very important to protect and show my loyalty to my homeland. But at the same time, my father, my Siruzirakzadeh is Iranian. My father, although he was agnostic, he was raised a Sufi version of Islam. And for him, life was precious. And he wouldn't, he wouldn't let us have guns at home. There was a point in my life I wanted to try archery and see if I could hunt, you know, in the woods. And he was so angry, and he said, no, absolutely not. And I internalized a lot of these attitudes, and it was a big, big struggle. So I decided I would go to college, I'd enroll in ROTC, and I would see if I could become a legal officer, and maybe that would be a good way to serve the country, and yet support it, defend it, and yet not actually be engaged, directly engaged in violence. So that's how I went to college, and I had a mixed skill set. I was very, very good in mathematics for reasons I'm not entirely sure. I think part of the reason was my father was a mathematician, and I was eager to please him. But the flip side, because my family, my mother is Guatemalan, my father's Iranian, because they came to the United States, they were very concerned about me fitting in. And in those days, it was the late 1950s, early 1960s, there were a lot of open expressions of racism in Colorado, and they wanted me not to have any accent, and they wanted me to, they really wanted me to fit in. And so I wasn't read it in the evening. I didn't learn stories that many of you were raised on, didn't know certain phrases. And my SAT scores, while they were very high in mathematics, were quite low in English and in literature. Now, I don't want to give the false impression that they didn't love me, because in fact, I think they loved me a lot. And I was an unusual child. They really had prepped me for college. I was kind of developmentally awkward in a way that I don't, that maybe all of us are. So I was very roly-poly as an infant, and lumpy, and in terms of my abilities, my physical coordination, I couldn't crawl forwards. I could only crawl backwards. And so my mother was a little worried about that and what it might mean. And then also I had a kind of a thermostat problem that's persisted with me my whole life. I sweat very, very easily when, yeah, I'll tell you about it. Hey! So especially when I was small and roly-poly and everything, in those days they didn't have deodorant. They had a lot of talcum powder, which only hid the smell so long. And so my mom, all mothers, this is Mother's Day, mothers come up with little cute names for their children. And so my mom's name for me was Cebollita. And cebolla, for those of you who wonder what Spanish, cebolla is the bulb of an onion. And so her nickname for me was her little onion. And so anyhow, this is a child that they worked really hard to develop, and off I go to college. And three events occurred that I think are really important and I want to share with you. First, did I hear a baby cry? Mothers really love their babies, yes. when I went to college, in those days, I was assigned an advisor at the University of Michigan, who was a professor of Spanish literature. The idea here was that if you had someone advising you who was sensitive to your ethnic background, you would be steered in the right direction and enjoy success. And also at the University of Michigan, they had something called the Raw Carrot Exam. That was the student's nickname. I'm sure it had a more official sounding name. But they would ask you things like, how many steps do you go up when you're going up the stairs? Do you go one step at a time, two steps at a time? Do you like your carrots raw or cooked? When you enter a room, do you go to the center of the room? Do you go to the edges? What is the age of the people that you like to talk to when you're meeting strangers? And off this profile, they predicted what you would be good at. And according to that profile, I'd be very good in the sciences and mathematics, and I really should stay out of humanities and social sciences. So I took my first political science course, and what had happened is at that point I was a cross-country runner. I ran up Pikes Peak in the marathon. Pikes Peak Marathon, came down with bronchitis. So, what a life. And I was really paying attention, and I enjoyed the course tremendously. And a graduate student came up to me afterwards and said, you really know how to reason on this topic, and you know how to balance and think about counterarguments. Have you thought about going to graduate school? And I mentioned this to my advisor, and my advisor said, no, this will be a disaster. We need to have you graduate. You should not go into any social science or humanities. You will not succeed. And luckily, I found another advisor. It was through the honors program, which is the reason that I respect the honors program so much. And the honors program advisor said, you have a lot of talent. You don't even know what the limits of your talent are. Why don't you do it? Why, if this is something you think you might be interested in, follow your heart. And through a lot of work, I enjoyed success, and I think that's the first thing that's really important. First general point, you have talents in you that no one else can appreciate. Please, I hope Here, people have pushed you in new directions. Never let anyone tell you what you can or cannot do. Second thing that happened to me that was sort of noteworthy that I'd like to share with you is, because I was in ROTC, you wore uniforms and you walked across campus for your weekly ROTC class. And at that time, during the war, the University of Michigan was a center of controversy. And the editor of the newspaper was this man called Tom Hayden, which some of the students may not be familiar with. I think a lot of the parents and grandparents may. And Tom Hayden was one of the founders of the Students for Democratic Society and one of the authors of the Port Huron Statement. He was a radical. And there was that tension on campus. The year before I arrived, there was an attempt to burn down the ROTC building. So I walked across campus my first time, and it was the first time in my life that I had been spat upon. And a lot of things had happened to me in Colorado. I've been called lots of names, but that was something that was, that amount of hatred was brand new to me. And on my floor, there were a number of campus leaders of the Student for Democratic Society, and we often talked late at night. They were trying to reason with me, and I was trying to make them understand my position. And as the semester went on, I started to notice that they'd walk with me across campus, shoo away people who were heckling me. And then when we got to the ROTC building, they and the ROTC students, I think there was over the years a kind of mutual communication and understanding, would kind of trade me off. And I think what was important to me then is, up to that time, I had read Time magazine. I thought I knew what it meant to be a radical, and I thought I knew what it meant to be on the left and right. And I realized that words are very, very dangerous. They make the world comprehensible, but they also are incomplete renderings, and that it's important always to move beyond slogans. And whenever you use a term, you should be asking yourself both what is it disclosing, what is it helping me see, and also what is it disguising, and what is it hiding from me. The last event that I want to tell you about was a mixer I attended my first year. College was very different in those days than today. There were not co-ed dormitories and co-ed floors. Things were quite segregated. And so there were mixers that you went to hone your social skills and learn how to behave. And I went to a mixer, and there was a very attractive pitcher on the other team, a blonde, and afterwards I asked her if she wanted to go out on a date. Okay, well, kind of the ironic twist to this is she angrily said no. And she informed me that she was a radical lesbian. And she lectured me on my prejudice, on my failure to be broad in my sense of the way that people could have sexual orientations, my limited understanding about how men and women can relate to each other. And it's, you know, it seemed like a lifetime on the diamond as I was being lectured. It probably was only about 10 or 15 minutes. But what happened, and all of this is happening in 1970, so a lot of what we know today, we just didn't know back then. I was learning about types of discrimination and suffering and affliction that I just didn't see. And when I went back home to Colorado for Christmas and my mom saw me, she was stunned because I grew a mustache in ROTC. You could have a mild mustache. And she screamed as she opened the door, and my cebollita, what happened to you? And And then they were troubled because I was reading Milton and I was all this kind of Northern European stuff that they had never shared with me. And I was using words that, frankly, we didn't use in my household, that are academic terms. But I think especially if you're first generation immigrant and you're both from different countries and English is your second language, you might not use. And they were terms like intrinsic and ardor and solace and all these words that I've been exposed to. And I went to the local bar because in those days you could be 18 and drink. And I met with a bunch of my former athlete friends, and they began to do what at the time was quite common. They began to make jokes about homosexuality. And in the past, I'm very ashamed about this. In the past, I had participated, and I had laughed and joked. And after about two jokes, I felt very troubled and ashamed. And I said, you know, I just can't stay if this is going to be the discussion. And it was quite a strain, and these were lifelong friends that I had. And I'm proud of my decision. And I'm proud in it, not necessarily because I think I'm morally better than they are, because, in fact, many of them, for reasons of the draft, had to go to war, and they had to face moral dilemmas, and they came back, and we had long conversations. They had to deal with things I don't think I could ever deal with. But I am proud that I had decided that, and realized that I'm capable of changing directions. I'm not a vessel that information is poured into and values are poured into by my peers and my family. I am capable of questioning my assumptions and being principled in a non-dogmatic, non-passive way. So these are the things, these are changes I experienced, and I have a sense that you've experienced those changes also. I think more than you did before you came to the University of Connecticut, you have a passion for thinking things through, for being opposed to superficiality, for being opposed to slogans, for being opposed to questions, assumptions, and prejudices. Because you can focus so long on arguments that people think are closed, some people are going to find you to be absent-minded or eccentric, and in fact, what you're doing is being thoughtful and thorough. I think also all of you know that you're no longer passive about your values. You no longer, whatever your neighborhood, your community, your religion, you no longer simply carry those out. You are responsible for your values and principles. They can be reasoned about, they can be thought about, and you can do so without being dogmatic. And finally, my guess is that you have learned here how to read and look at works of art that are foreign to you, and to ask questions about people from different times and places, and to see different points of view, and ask about those who are afflicted, and those who are harmed, and those who are suffering, what are you going through? And I think that's that sort of sensitivity is just immeasurable, and I do believe that's part of being a scholar. I hope, over the years, you will take from us not only information and techniques, but the confidence that you have the ability to shape and define your lives, and that you have untapped potential, that you're going to flower over time. You're about to enter stages of your lives that are brand new. Some of you are starting new careers. Some of you are going to new cities. Some of you are going to have new social relations and friendships and loves and families. And I hope you bring this, all of these traits, the thoughtfulness, the sensitivity, the sense of responsibility to those situations. There are a lot of pressures in society to be embarrassed and to be quiet and to be silent. One of my favorite authors, Simone Weil, says that there are people who want us to become mute beings. And what she means by mute beings is that they want to treat us as if we have no capacity to resist. And I want you to fight that situation of conformity and predictability and encouragement of being mute. Provost Nichols talked about priceless memories. This day should be one of those priceless memories. I hope you remember the pride the teachers have in you. I hope you recall our faith in your energy and thoughtfulness and passion. I hope you always value the scholarly side. It brings amazement and joy to the world. It's part of what makes you irreplaceable and interesting, and it's part of what makes society dynamic. On behalf of my colleagues and the faculty and staff, I want to say that it's been an honor to meet you. It's been an honor to work with you, and it's been an honor to grow alongside you. May you and your loved ones have happy and healthy lives. Thank you.